Warning, this episode contains content that might be disturbing for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Hallie Latham Illingworth was born on January 7, 1901, in Greenville, Kentucky. Her parents were Phinehas and Mary Latham, a hardworking farming couple, and she had five siblings. Hallie had moved around a lot in her young adult life, and at 35 years old, where our story begins, she had two failed marriages. Her first marriage was in 1919, when she was just 18 years old, to Floyd James Spraker, and her second marriage was in 1933 to a man named Donald B. Strickland. After her second divorce, Hallie was in search of both a better job and a better life. She moved to Port Angeles, Washington in 1936 and took a job as a barmaid and waitress at Lake Crescent Tavern, now known as Lake Crescent Lodge. While working there, she met a man by the name of Montgomery J. Illingworth. Montgomery, or Monty, which is what he went by, was a beer delivery truck driver and was known to be a bit of a ladies' man. He also had a bit of a reputation for not being the best romantic partner, as in, well, he was an asshole. Their relationship was fast-paced, and they were married not long after meeting on June 16, 1936. It was clear that their relationship was a volatile one. They fought regularly, and shortly after their nuptials, Hallie began showing up to work with bruises on her face and arms. 5 months into their marriage, they had a fight so violent and loud that neighbors had to call the cops to break it up. The seemingly incessant fighting and obvious physical abuse went on for another year after that until one day, Hallie just stopped showing up to work completely. She didn't contact friends or family or notify anyone for that matter if she had a plan to leave. Except, well, there was one person who seemed to know exactly what happened and where she went. Monty, of course. When loved ones or coworkers began to ask where she went, he informed them that she had run away to Alaska with another man. And that was that. 5 months later, Monty filed for a divorce, remarried, and moved to California. It is believed that he was seeing this woman before Hallie went missing, and that was the end of the story. For a little while, at least. Hallie was last seen in the early morning hours of December 22, 1927, and she wouldn't be seen again until July 6, 1940, almost 3 years after her disappearance. Two fishermen were on Lake Crescent, about 17 miles west of Port Angeles in Olympia National Park. They were shocked and horrified when they saw a body of a woman floating in the water. However, this body wasn't decomposed and bloated from the water like most floaters tend to be. The majority of the body was intact, with the exception of the face and the fingertips, which were basically just exposed bone at that point. This, for obvious reasons, made it difficult for investigators to identify the body immediately. No face to identify, and no fingerprints. The seemingly well-preserved Jane Doe was transported into Port Angeles from the water and examined. The body had saponified, meaning it had turned into a hard, waxy, soap-like consistency. This process was made possible by the chemical makeup of Lake Crescent, whose pristine, clear, crystal blue water has a low nitrogen level, which makes it difficult for algae to grow. The water is also deep, up to 624 feet at its deepest point, and it has a surface area of 5,127 acres, making it the second largest lake in the state of Washington. Lake Crescent was created when a massive landslide separated it from Lake Sutherland about 7,000 years ago. And while those last few facts have nothing to do with the reasons why Hallie's body was essentially turned into a soap mummy, they were interesting to me nonetheless. So, there you go. During the examination and autopsy of her body, it was discovered that she had several contusions around her neck, multiple other bruises on her body, and hemorrhaging in her chest. It was obvious that she had been beaten violently and strangled to death. The body was then bound with rope, wrapped in a blanket, weighted down, and thrown into the lake. After some time in the water, however, the restraints that secured the weights broke and the body floated to the surface. Hallie had a dental plate, which my first thought was, what the hell is that? Dentures, maybe? I had no idea and was trying to make an educated guess. So, to be sure, I looked it up, and according to the Dental Health Society, quote, a dental plate is a term referring to any removable dental prosthetic. This covers any type of false teeth, full dentures, partial dentures, or removable bridges. So, yeah. Some form of removable false teeth or other dental prosthetic that would have been made specifically for her mouth. They would have been distinct and unique to her. A chart of this dental plate was made and published in several dental journals, and it just so happened that a previous dental provider for Hallie in South Dakota saw the images and recognized it as one he had made for her years prior. Dental records proved that the Jane Doe was, in fact, Hallie Latham Illingworth. With the body being positively identified and the cause of death being so obvious, all that was left was to find the killer. After doing an investigation and following some leads, it was confirmed that the rope used to bind Hallie's body matched fibers from one that Monty, apparently borrowed from a local shopkeeper. Seems kind of stupid to use a borrowed rope. Maybe that's just me, but I also don't think he ever intended on her body being found either. Investigators found Monty living in Long Beach, California, where he was arrested on October 26, 1941, and he was then extradited back to Port Angeles, Washington, to stand trial for the murder of his wife. The trial began on February 24, 1942. Montgomery Illingworth denied having anything to do with Hallie's death, but on March 5th, he was found guilty of second-degree murder because it was believed to be a crime of passion and not premeditated. He was sentenced to life in prison. However, he was paroled after only 9 years. After he was released, Montgomery moved back to California, where he lived until he passed away on November 5, 1975, at the age of 67. Running along Lake Crescent is the Spruce Railroad Trail. The trail is about a 4-mile hike one way, or an 8-mile loop, and it is part of the 134-mile-long Olympic Discovery Trail. The Spruce Railroad Trail is rumored to be haunted by a woman known as the Lady of the Lake. She roams the trail, crying out for help, and is even seen gliding across the top of the lake. She is said to be glowing and translucent, and she is reportedly none other than the ghost of Hallie Latham Illingworth herself. Another incident of note is that of a couple, Russell and Blanche Warren, ages 35 and 33 respectively. On July 3, 1929, the couple were heading home from Port Angeles. They lived in a logging camp on the Bogachiel River near Forks, and the path they took led them down the US 101 that ran alongside Lake Crescent. Back then, the road was narrow and had a low guardrail. They had plans to celebrate Independence Day with their two sons the following day, who were, at the time, either 11 and 13 or 12 and 14, depending on the source. Rumors that the couple had abandoned their boys seemed downright ridiculous to friends of the family. Mr. Warren had gone into Port Angeles to pick up his wife from the hospital. She was having some health issues, and they had to run some errands as well. Their sons were left home with $35 in case of an emergency and were told by Russell that he and their mother would be home by the next day at the very latest. The Warrens, unfortunately, never arrived home, though. They and their car seemingly disappeared without a trace. Two weeks later, an investigation began. Tire marks and broken glass were found on the road by the river near Meldrum Point. Despite a 2-month-long investigation that included searches being done and divers scouring the water, plus a reward that was offered, nothing came up and the case went cold. Now, mind you, at the time, divers could only reach a depth of about 78 feet. In 2002, armed with better equipment, volunteers and divers of the National Park Service were able to reach the depth of approximately 170 feet where the Warren's 1927 Chevrolet was found sitting at the bottom of Lake Crescent. The bodies, however, weren't discovered. A couple years later, some bones were found believed to have been the skull and femurs of Russell Warren. The living relatives were relieved to finally have some answers and decided to leave the car where it lay as a watery grave for the couple who had already been there for so long. Sadly, Russell and Blanche's sons both died before the truth about their parents' disappearance was ever discovered. Mr. and Mrs. Warren were the victims of an unfortunate accident when they were just trying to get home to their sons, who, unfortunately, went to their grave believing that they were abandoned by their parents. So I just mentioned Meldrum Point a little bit ago. It is also known as Madrona Point and Ambulance Point. It got its latter name after an ambulance swerved off the road and into the water on August 27, 1956. The ambulance was returning to Port Angeles after picking up a lumberjack in Forks who had a broken leg. Ernest Monroe Dahlgren was strapped to the gurney to protect him and his injured leg during the nearly hour-long transport. Due to this, when the ambulance plunged into the water, he was unable to escape, and the result was fatal. The two paramedics were able to make it to safety, though. Just a few years later, on January 24, 1960, Dan Steele was driving his 1950 Dodge sedan, accompanied by three others, when he slipped on the icy road and also wound up hurling into the frigid water of Lake Crescent. Fortunately, in this case, everyone was able to escape and survived. One of those individuals was a woman named Beverly Sherman. After hearing about the discovery of the Warrens' vehicle, she contacted the divers, and the Dodge was also discovered. It was located roughly 600 feet from the Warrens' Chevrolet and at a depth of around 190 feet. Are you thinking of starting your own podcast? Well, let me tell you about Buzzsprout. They are an amazing podcast hosting site who do all of the hard work for you so you can focus on your content without the extra stress. They automatically upload your podcast episodes and get you listed on all major listening platforms. You get a beautiful podcast website at no extra cost to you, detailed analytics, tools to help you promote your podcast, and so much more. I personally am in love with the Magic Mastering function. It helps clean up the sound quality without pouring hours into editing. Buzzsprout has a plan suited for everyone and their needs. The team at Buzzsprout is passionate about helping you and your podcast succeed. Right now, Buzzsprout is offering our listeners a $20 Amazon gift card when you sign up for a paid plan. Following the link in the show notes lets Buzzsprout know that we sent you. Join the over 100,000 podcasters already using Buzzsprout. Click the link in the show notes and get your podcast started today. Now, on to another crazy detail about Lake Crescent's more recent history. This involves a serial killer, Israel Keyes. He was honestly a terrifying excuse for a human. I'm going to touch on him and his life in a lot less detail than I normally would, because I could literally do a whole ass episode on him, but I really wanted to include this in this episode. I just don't know that I'm ready to delve that deeply into the mind of another fucked up serial killer and rapist again. So, for the sake of time and my sanity, I'll just give you a summarization of his life and the case. I'm going to kind of move quickly here too, so bear with me. Israel Keyes was born on January 7, 1978, in Richmond, Utah, to a Mormon family. His parents were John, Jeffrey, and Heidi Keyes, and he was the second eldest of 10 children. They were homeschooled and were taught Mormon beliefs until John and Heidi left the church. After this, in 1983, when Israel was 5 years old, his father relocated the family to a remote area north of Colville, Washington. He moved the family into a single-room cabin with no electricity or running water. Now, that's not a lot of living space or ideal conditions for a growing family. Let's face it, none of us really need electricity or running water to survive, but our modern conveniences sure do make things a hell of a lot easier for us. At a young age, Israel was introduced to two different churches. One that was focused on Christian identity and white supremacy beliefs, and another that taught British idealism. Now, both of these churches were extremely racially driven and leaned real hard into the bullshit idea that one race and ethnicity were superior to all the others. While attending the former church mentioned, the Keys befriended Chevy O'Brien Kehoe, who, along with his partner Daniel Lewis Lee, were convicted of a triple homicide that happened in 1996. Maybe not necessarily a prelude of things to come, but interesting nonetheless. As the Keyes family grew, some of the children had to sleep in tents outside because the cabin wasn't big enough to accommodate them all. The children were also responsible for hunting for their own food, working on local farms to help support the family, and chopping firewood for the family. Living such a secluded, almost reclusive life didn't really give Israel the skills that he needed to socialize among his peers. His hobbies included shooting BB guns at other houses, breaking and entering, theft and hunting, quote, anything with a heartbeat, that's from his own mouth, or even just flat-out torturing animals sometimes. He began to realize that his behavior was extremely off-putting to other kids and withdrew into himself more and more as time went on. As a teenager, he developed skills in construction, and these would serve him later in his adult life as well. The family relocated to Maine sometime around 1997, and shortly thereafter, Israel declared his atheism and was essentially exiled from the family. After violently sexually assaulting a teenage girl in Oregon, by his own confession, he quickly left the area and headed to New Jersey. In 1998, he enlisted in the army, and by all accounts, he seemed to have done well in the service. He did tend to drink heavily on the weekends, though, and in February of 2001, he earned himself a DUI. He was subsequently discharged from the army, honorably, mind you. He then moved to Nia Bay, Washington for a while before again relocating in 2007. This time to Alaska, where he opened his own construction business. Now, at some point he met a woman and had a daughter with her. I'm not 100% positive if this was before or after his move to Alaska, but I'm pretty sure it was after. Now that we know a little bit about his background, let's talk about what he did. As I already stated, Israel was a serial killer, but he was methodical. He studied the work of FBI profilers and other serial killers. Not only did he admire them, but he also wanted to try and learn from the mistakes that they made. He traveled frequently and had caches, which were basically just murder kits buried all over the states. When he traveled, he removed his battery from his cell phone and he only paid for things in cash. I briefly mentioned that at a young age he had a thing for theft and burglary, but that escalated, and he began robbing banks to help fund his travels and murder spree. He was also an arsonist, among many other things. The majority of what we know about him are from his confessions, and we may never truly know the full scope of what he actually did, but I think it's safe to say that he was capable of horrible things. He was an opportunist. He didn't have a specific victim profile, and that's one thing that made him so damn terrifying. It's difficult to catch someone who doesn't follow a pattern. He struck at random and never in the same place twice. He also wouldn't commit murders close to where he lived. That is, until the end. It is suspected that Keyes murdered at least 11 people, but only 3 have been definitively linked to him. In the end, he got way too bold and honestly lazy, and that's what got him caught. One of his most well-known victims is Samantha Koenig. She was an 18-year-old barista in Anchorage, Alaska. She was abducted from the coffee shop she worked at and then violently raped and murdered by Keyes. He left the area using her debit card to help fund a little trip away. He took his family on a damn cruise while Samantha's brutalized body sat in a fucking shed. Her disappearance would absolutely not go unnoticed. When he returned to Alaska, Keyes applied makeup to Samantha's corpse and sewed her eyes open. He then took a photo of her with a recent newspaper. This was enough to make her family believe that she was still alive, and he demanded a $30,000 ransom that was deposited into Samantha's account. Keyes went on the road again, but not before dismembering Samantha and throwing her body into a lake north of Anchorage, where she would later be recovered. When he was traveling around Texas, Israel continued to use Samantha's debit card to withdraw cash from various ATMs, which, fucking duh, can be traced. They also have surveillance cameras, and a lookout bulletin was circulated with a description of the suspect's car. On March 13, 2012, Israel Keyes was pulled over in the vehicle matching the description for driving slightly above the speed limit. Visible to officers was some cash that had bright ink stains on it, an obvious sign that it was from a bank robbery and a dye pack had exploded. His car was then searched, and Samantha's ATM card and cell phone were also discovered. Keyes was arrested and extradited to Alaska, where he confessed to the murder of Samantha Koenig. And he also confessed to a lot more than that. In 2011, he murdered a couple named Bill and Lorraine Currier. He broke into their home and subdued them both before transporting them to an abandoned farmhouse. Lorraine was raped before she was murdered. This was confirmed to be done by Keyes based off of the information he gave investigators. He also claimed to have killed at least 5 other people, but he gave no names, so these were never confirmed or identified. There are also several others who are suspected to be the victims of Keyes as well, but because he is dead, we'll probably never really know. Yeah, about that. While being held on suspicion of murder, Israel Keyes managed to hide a razor blade in his cell, and on December 2, 2012, he died of suicide by slitting his wrists and self-strangulation. This was just months before his trial was set to begin, so he was never actually convicted of the murders he committed. But we know who was responsible for a few of them at least. An FBI report stated that Keyes burglarized between 20 and 30 homes across the states, in addition to robbing several banks between 2001 and 2012. In addition, they suspect he is responsible for at least 11 murders. Now, I'm sure you're wondering, what the hell does this have to do with Lake Crescent? Well, while he was incarcerated, Keyes talked to investigators. A lot. During an interview, he claimed that he had disposed of one of his victims' bodies in none other than Lake Crescent. Car wrecks, murders, death, saponification. That word's just fun to say. Saponification. This episode was honestly supposed to go in a completely different direction than it did. My bad. But once I started down the rabbit hole that is Lake Crescent, I could not stop. And then Israel Keyes came up and I'm like, I have to include this. I tried really hard to keep his part short since it wasn't really focused around Lake Crescent, but it's hard for me not to try to give all the information. I really did like leave a lot out of that one though, so... Anyways, the next episode, I will refocus on the topic I had intended for this one. On another note, I'm going to get an email set up specifically for the podcast and make it public on the next episode. The purpose of this is so that I can hear from you, my listeners. Think about topics that you would like to hear me talk about on the show or any personal stories you would like me to share, be them true crime related, paranormal, involving cryptids. Basically, anything weird, spooky, and strange, I'm fucking here for it. I plan on eventually compiling listener stories and reading them here on special, like, little miniature masquerade episodes. So, if you have a personal story of your own, don't hold back. Send me that shit. I want it. I need it. I don't plan on disappearing on you guys anytime soon, at least not without warning. But this freaking cold and flu season has been extra brutal on my family. I mean, clearly, I sound like trash again because we were all sick this past week. Again. Some more. I guess. I don't know. I don't even know if I've gotten completely better since the beginning of October. Maybe for like a few days? Possibly? But I do feel like I am finally at a point where I feel more comfortable with the whole process of putting this whole podcast together, and I have already come a long way since my first episode, which I am honestly thinking about going back and remastering that one and fixing all the editing and the things that I do not like about it. So that might happen. Maybe I'll do that Covina Massacre case again soon, since it's, you know, coming up on Christmas. I don't know. Eventually that has to happen, though. But as always, you know, thank you to everyone who has stuck by me through all the ups and downs. If you like the show, please, 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 please share it with your friends and rate it wherever you are listening. Word of mouth is literally the driving force behind this podcast now. I have no social media. So spread the word. If you like it, share it. I'd appreciate it. And... as always, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Aurora, and this has been The Dark Masquerade.